yellow glass. Of the Gruber family, only Gertrude and Lotte remained. Frau Gruber had died before the war began in earnest, and Benita's brothers lay beside her in the town graveyard. Georg, the youngest, shot God knows where in Russia, and Hans, dead of an infection caught in a military hospital. Sophie, the second oldest Gruber daughter, had married an American soldier and moved to a place called Kansas. This was both marvelous and galling to Benita. How could plain, quiet Sophie, who had always been so content in Frühlinghausen, have been the one to escape? Lotte and Gertrude lived side by side in a row of new stucco cottages with matching lace curtains over the windows and tiny gardens full of practical plantings. Potatoes, cabbage, carrots, and parsley. It made Benita want to cry.
"Tired of life in the castle?"
Lotte said with a smirk when Benita first stepped off the train. Gertrude was kinder. "As I would be happy that you came back." But unfortunately, Benita was staying with Lotte, whose children had already left home. Her daughter had married the local butcher, and her son was studying in Braunschweig to become a government clerk. The Grubers, now Freisholzes, thanks to Lotte's unpleasant husband, Gebhardt, were moving up in the world. Benita found this a good joke, but there was no one to share it with. The beginning of December marked 3 months since Benita had been back. Lotte, who was always prickly, was now downright peevish. Whether this was because of Benita's continued presence or Gebhardt's prolonged absence was impossible to know. Gebhardt had gone south to see his ailing mother shortly after Benita's arrival, and for the last 2 weeks, Lotte had eagerly awaited his return. Maybe the delay brought to mind the long years she had spent raising children, while he did God knows what in a Siberian labor camp. Or maybe the constant effort of preparing a hot dinner in expectation set her on edge. Benita slunk around the house like a person trying not to wake a sleeping baby. But even so, she managed to get on Lotta's nerves.
"Benita,"
Lotte said when Benita let herself into the cottage one afternoon,
"have you thought about applying for a job at Wiesemann's?"
Benita had not even unwrapped her scarf. Wiesemann's had opened recently, a narrow grocery with no windows and a heavy smell of cigarette smoke, long shelves of canned and packaged goods. These were not in high demand in Frühlinghausen, where almost everyone still grew their own produce, canned their own fruit, and bought their meat from the butcher. Benita had set foot inside the place exactly once.
"Lotte, let poor Benita catch her breath,"
Gertrude chided from the table where she sat cracking nuts for Christmas cookies.
"Isn't that what she was just doing, strolling around in the fresh air?"
"It's all right," Benita said, shedding her coat. She knew better than to bristle at Lotta's barbs.
"Are they looking for someone?" "I should think so. I heard Trude complaining about the long hours. Dawn till dusk, and no one to fill in besides her and Horst. Apparently she never sees him anymore. So I don't know if that's really much to complain about."
Lotte slipped into an imitation of a man with a stiff back and pained face. Lotte had once been the class cut-up, a brash, big-boned, and funny girl everyone was slightly afraid of. And she maintained a little of this demeanor as an adult.
"Lotte," Gertrude chided. "Horst is a nice man." "Who said he wasn't?"
Lotte cracked a walnut with particular violence. She and Gertrude had their own way of communicating, a kind of closeness achieved through years of living side by side, sharing the profound and the mundane. Benita existed entirely outside its confines, a subject of their conversation rather than a participant.
"Well, he is nice,"
Gertrude said to Benita.
"It's true."
Obviously, they had discussed the job already. Benita was their mutual problem to solve.
"I'll go tomorrow," Benita said.
She had tried to find work already, first at the local kindergarten, but she had no experience, then with Frau Kurtzdorf, the town seamstress. But she did not know how to work a sewing machine. She had even applied at a department store a long bus ride away in Bremel, but was told she was too old. Too old, The portly Dutchman conducting the interview had given her a lascivious once-over even as he pronounced this. It made her furious and despairing in turn. But what could she do but keep trying? Lotta needed money for coal and provisions. Gebhardt either could or would not work. It was unclear which. In any case, he contributed nothing by way of household income. And beneath her scornful demeanor, Lotta was worn out. She worked long hours in the canning factory office. Benita could not blame her for wanting support, and she did not want to be a burden. Standing in the small, chilly parlor with its familiar lamp on the table, the same one Frau Gruber had kept in a place of honor in her own dingy parlor, Benita knew she should sit down beside Gertrude and help shell the walnuts, that she should make conversation and inquire whether there was any news of Gebhardt, or ask what the church had planned for the first Sunday of Advent, or whether Gertrude's children were over their colds. But she could not.
"I have a headache. I'm going to lie down a moment," she said instead.
"Of course you are," Lotta retorted, raising her eyebrows in Gertrude's direction.
"That's our Benita."
Upstairs, Benita sank onto her narrow bed and looked at the photograph of Martin that hung beside it. In it, he was about 9. His arms were outstretched, his hair ruffled by wind. It was taken in the field below Burg Lingenfels. The grass rose to his knees, and Benita could almost hear the skylarks and swallows, the papery rustle of grasshoppers. It had been a beautiful, warm afternoon, a picnic with Marianne and Anya and all the children, at the end of their time living in the castle. There had been resistance to the plan in the beginning. Elisabeth had wanted to stay inside and read her book. Fritz had complained of a toothache. And Benita herself had wanted to go into Tollingen to shop for a new hat. But Marianne had prevailed. It was the perfect day for a picnic, she insisted. And she wanted to take photographs with her new camera. Photographs of a picnic. Both Anya and Benita had been appalled. In their experience, cameras were precious, delicate tools, reserved exclusively for formal portraits. Not toys to be toted along to take pictures of sweaty, disorderly children running wild. But how right Marianne had been to insist. The day had been wonderful, one of the happiest of Benita's life. And in the photograph of Martin running, Marianne had captured a rare and unguarded moment of joy. Here was the thing Benita was most proud of. She had raised a boy capable of such feeling. Somehow, despite everything, he could experience this.
"Why did you decide to go back to Frühlinghausen?"
he had asked in his first letter, and she had answered as best she could. There was no reason for her to rely on Marianne's hospitality any longer, and it was important to be near her sisters. Lotta needed her help with the house. She knew her answers were thin, but Martin seemed to have accepted them because he had not asked again. In his last letter, he had written of an invitation. A wealthy classmate from an old family had asked him to spend the winter holiday skiing with them in Switzerland. He was reluctant to accept.
"I don't want to leave you alone at Christmas, Mother," he wrote. "I could stay with you in Frühlinghausen. Does Lotta have room?"
The thought depressed Benita. She hated the idea of him here among Lotta, Gertrude, and their families. He would have to sit beside Gebhardt in the dingy church pew she had loathed as a child. He would have to eat with people who gobbled their food in silence and wiped their mouths with the backs of their hands. This was not what she had raised him to be.
"No," she had insisted. "Accept the invitation. You can come visit in the new year. It will be good for you to learn how to ski."
So he would spend Christmas on the slopes of St. Moritz with some happy family of dukes and duchesses. It was better this way, but at the same time, her heart ached. She would content herself with his image and letters, and the knowledge that he was happy. The next day she steeled herself for an interview at Wiesemann's. Lotta, being Lotta, had gone over first thing in the morning and laid the groundwork. God knows what embarrassing things she had told them. In any case, she reported, the owners were happy to meet with Benita. In fact, Trude Wesselmann remembered her from their days together in the BDM. This startled Benita. She did not remember a Trude Wesselmann. Lotta stared at her impatiently. Trude Schultz. She had married a Wesselmann. A face presented itself to Benita. Pale and large-eyed, with pimply skin and dark hair pulled back into tight braids. Of course. Benita felt the stirring of hope. They had shared experience to go on. Not friendship, but a connection. All those long hours with Fräulein Briebel, singing Nazi Volkslieder and slogging through arduous Sunday hikes. All that ridiculous homemaker training, stamping butter and aerating batter and generally learning skills the war would render useless. There would maybe be something to laugh about. But when she arrived, she did not recognize the woman who opened the door. Over the years, Trude had grown stout, and her pimples had given way to pockmarks. Her hair had gone prematurely gray. Benita realized with dismay that she had seen this woman around town once or twice already, and not acknowledged their connection. Trude, she said warmly, offering her best smile. Trude nodded her head curtly, rejecting Benita's familiar tone. Had she felt snubbed by their recent encounters? Benita resolved to be particularly self-deprecating and complimentary. How long it's been since the days of Fräulein Briebel, she said. And you look wonderful. Not a day older.
I certainly look days older,
Trude sniffed, shaking her head.
Come this way. Horst is in the parlor.
Benita followed. Had Trude not liked her as a girl? She could not remember. But often someone had been sweet on someone who was sweet on Benita, and this had made for hard feelings. Maybe Trude had hankered after Paul Heinecke? Or Axel Pittman? Those years were a great meaningless fuzz in Benita's mind. Following the woman's stiff back down the hall, Benita reproached her teenage self. What had she done back then? And why had she cared so little? In the parlor, Horst rose from behind a messy desk. He was a quite thin, balding man with stooped shoulders and a tired air, quite like Lotta's imitation. Benita extended her hand.
So nice to meet you, she began. Frillinghausen is lucky to have your store.
Trude made an impatient gesture.
Ugh, sit down, sit down.
She waved away Benita's words.
Stung,
Benita complied. So did Horst. It was clear who was in charge. Horst offered an apologetic smile.
So, Frau Gruber, pardon Frau Fledermann, is looking for a position as a clerk.
Trude stated flatly.
What are the days we need help on our schedule?
Well,
Horst rustled the papers on his desk.
We could work around the times Frau Fledermann has available as...
Come, Horst,
Trude broke in.
What are the hours on the schedule in front of you?
I'm very flexible,
Benita offered.
I'm sure I could...
Do you have experience with a cash register?
Trude interrupted.
Not with a cash register, no,
Benita began.
But I could learn. So you don't know it already?
Trude asked, as if this were preposterous.
No.
Benita shook her head. At his desk, Horst cleared his throat. Trude let out a sharp bark of laughter.
So then, surely you did not think we would hire you out of charity?
Benita looked at her. Her face was the embodiment of Frühlinghausen, all the meanness and small-mindedness Benita had always despised, only transformed from an indifferent force to a specific ugly power, a highly evolved venom to which she was uniquely susceptible.
No,
Benita said with as much dignity as she could summon, and gathered her bag and hat.
I know you have none of that.
She walked through the town like a blind woman. And in her humiliation, she did not notice the telltale signs that Gebhardt had returned. The hat and boots in the doorway vestibule. The dirty plate and napkin on the table. She made her way upstairs without even removing her coat. In her small room under the eaves, she was greeted by a surprise. An unfamiliar steamer trunk. An old suitcase. and a carpet bag she recognized. The sight jolted Vinita, momentarily, from her misery. Her belongings. She had asked Marianne to pack them for Gebhardt to retrieve. His mother lived not far from Tollingen. Marianne had objected. Wouldn't Vinita come herself so they could have a chance to visit? But Vinita had remained steadfast. And Gebhardt, for all his usual crankiness, was oddly amenable to playing porter. Maybe he was curious to see where Vinita had been living, or to meet this Countess Marianne, a meeting that was at once comical and horrifying for Vinita to imagine. In any case, he had obviously returned. And with him, her old life. Vinita stood in the middle of the room and listened. But the house was silent. Her possessions, piled on the small rug, seemed utterly unassimilable. The fine porcelain jewelry box Marianne had given her, the pretty scarves, the high-heeled shoes she had bought in Munich last year, her favorite dresses. The idea of these treasures here, in this house, in Frühlinghausen, depressed her. Who was there to look pretty for? Even if there were someone, she wouldn't want him. She missed Franz with a physical ache. He had known her, really known her. The best and the worst parts. He was the narrow bridge that connected the two. A step sounded in the hall outside her room.
"I nearly broke my back carrying all that upstairs," Gebhardt grumbled from the doorway.
He was a glowering, unpleasant man. Once a catch by Frühlinghausen standards, but he had thickened and calcified over time. Now he had a gut like a pregnant woman's belly, and restive eyes that made Vinita shudder. God knows what he had done during his time in the SS.
"I'm sorry," Vinita sighed. "Thank you."
She looked down, feeling the sting of her own dependence. Trude Wiesemann was right. She was a charity case. Gebhardt did not move from the doorway. When Vinita lifted her eyes, he was staring at her with a scornful, evaluative expression, one arm braced across the door, blocking the exit. It gave her a start.
"Where is Lotte?"
she asked. He made a choked snort.
"Where's Lotte?"
he repeated, still staring. With a chill, she recognized this look, with its particular mix of anger and lust. Vinita drew herself up.
"Come now," she said. "There's no need to be childish."
"Childish?"
he repeated, taking a step toward her, breathing fast. Mercifully, from downstairs came the sound of the front door opening.
"Lotte," Vinita called in a falsely light tone. "Is that you?"
"Who else?"
Lotte snapped. Gebhardt glared at Vinita.
"Gebhardt?"
Lotte exclaimed, apparently noting the signs of his return that Vinita had missed.
"Are you back?"
For a moment, he didn't speak. Vinita returned his glare.
"I'm here,"
he answered finally, turning on his heel. After he left, Vinita shut the door behind him and leaned against it for what seemed like an eternity. That evening she feigned a headache and did not go downstairs to dinner. Instead, she stayed in her room and opened the chest. She did so with a sense of duty rather than pleasure. First, there were the creams and perfumes she had collected over the past year, as the stores again began to stock such items. Then the combs for her hair, the scarves, the brooch Franz had given her. And beneath these, papers, the forms Marianne had helped her fill out as an Opfer, Martin's notes from school, her marriage license, written in stark, indecipherable Nazi script she shuddered to look at. She had half a mind to burn it, and then the shoebox of Franz's letters, tied prettily with a red and white ribbon. She had knotted the packet herself, and imagined rereading the letters together with Franz, one day when they were old. She could barely look at them now. But as she moved to replace the lid, she caught sight of something else. A longer, thinner envelope, much handled and slightly yellowed.
"To my wife, Vinita Fledermann,"
was written across the front, in a familiar, elegant script. The blood rushed to her head and away, leaving her faint.
Here was Connie's letter. The one Marianne had given her so many years ago. The one she had never opened. She had entirely forgotten that it existed. From downstairs, Benita could hear Lotta and Gephardt's conversation. The shrill warble of her sister's voice and her husband's low, insolent grunts. Raindrops pattered on the sloped roof. She lifted the letter gingerly, half expecting it to disappear at her touch. How could she have forgotten? The fact was preposterous. What kind of woman would forget a letter from her dead husband? Why had she never read it? In the beginning, she had been too angry. This was true. But afterward, she had simply let it slip. It filled her with shame. Benita opened the envelope. The letter was not long. But at first, her eyes refused to make sense of the words, which swam and jostled on the page. Gradually, though, they fell into place.
"My dearest Benita," it read.
She could hear Connie's voice. It had been so many years since she had heard it.
"If you are reading this, it means the plot I have given my life for has failed, that Hitler is still in power, and I am dead."
She felt that time rise up around her. The flat in Berlin, Martin playing marbles on the floor, the restless loneliness and anger, the shriek of the air raid siren.
"I am sorry, then, that I put this spike between us for nothing. That is what I most regret. I never meant to keep secrets from you, my love. I only wanted to protect you. The less you knew, the safer you would be. I could not let you bear responsibility for my actions. And I don't even know if you agree with them.
Our love is not a part of world events and politics. Our love has always been its own country. Benita, I am so sorry for the ways I have hurt you.
I know I have not been the husband you dreamed of. I have been foolish. I have been selfish. I have acted sometimes with my own interests, and our country's interests at heart. But I have always believed our future as individuals is fused with Germany's. If I, as a human being, don't act against Hitler, I cannot live with myself. If we Germans don't put out our own demon, he will never be exorcised. My dearest, I write this by way of explanation, if you should want one. But what I most want to say is that I loved you from the moment I saw you on the day of the Anschluss, by the mill pond, in your solemn little uniform, and I never stopped. Even now, as you read this, be happy. Care for our son. Raise him to know happiness as you do, and I will be with you. Yours always, Connie. Benita set the letter down. Connie, her dear Connie, whom she had never even said goodbye to, whom she had hated, really hated for so long. But he had always been strong. He had lived his life on a plane of grand ideals and all-encompassing rights and wrongs. His view had been much longer than the trappings of his own life, and she had been the little mouse who could see no farther than her own nose, stumbling over roots and stones, oblivious to the oncoming storm. She sat for a long time. Night deepened outside. The rain passed and stars shone. A sliver of a moon rose, shedding no light. Her collection of objects lay in heaps. No more substantial than the scraps of leaves and paper a bird might use to shore up her nest. Somewhere, out in the world, Franz Müller moved through life, serving dinner to Clotilde and his father on the yellow tablecloth, or working late in his coffin shop. And somewhere, Marianne was doing God knows what, writing, organizing, dining with friends. Marianne never just sat. And Martin, her own son. Benita imagined him in his room at Zalem, head bent over his books, improving his life. There was a purpose to each of their lives. Even Franz was responsible for old Herr Müller and Clotilde. Only Benita had no purpose. She had already raised her son. All she could do now was hold him back. She was a woman built for love,
But love was dead, at least to her and to her generation. There was no place left for it in this world. And yet, she had never wanted anything else. In the dark, she removed her dress and jewelry and lay down on the bed. She took one of the pills Lotta's doctor had prescribed to help her sleep. And as the warm, floating feeling of a dream came on, she took another pill into her hand. She saw Connie's face as it was when he had come to her that last night, and it felt almost possible to go back, to turn to him and say goodbye and good luck, to give him her blessing. And she saw Martin in her arms, as a baby, his sweet, innocent face lighting up when she bent toward him. To this, too, she could return. She took a few more pills, and then the rest, swallowed them with one gulp, and then she lay back down. Chapter 31 Frühlinghausen, December 1950. The train ride from Tollingen to Frühlinghausen was long and full of transfers. 3 minutes to change trains in Frankfurt, 7 in Kassel, 20 in Göttingen. Everything was once again on time. In the cities, bombed-out remains of buildings had been oddly integrated into the general forward motion of life, like assimilated amputations, noticeable only to strangers, such as those passing through on trains. Marianne and Martin managed, for the last leg of their journey, to find an empty compartment. It was not a busy travel time. Midday, midweek, children at school, adults at work. Everyone was caught up in the reassuring web of industry. Only the travelers had come unstuck.
"When the war ended, why did my mother go to you instead of her family?"
Martin asked, startling Marianne. She had almost forgotten he was sitting across from her, wrapped in his own cloak of grief. He had grown tall in the last months at school, and his legs sprawled across the aisle, his shoulders hunched forward like folded wings.
"It made sense at the time," Marianne said. "Everything was mixed up.
No one was where they started.
And I don't think..."
She stopped herself. She was unsure what Benita had related to Martin about her family. "But," Martin pressed. Marianne sighed.
"I don't think she was close to her family."
Martin turned back to stare out the window. One after another, poor, dilapidated farm flew past. Prosperity had returned to Germany, but not to this corner of the country. Martin did not ask the obvious question. Why, then, had Benita gone back to Frühlinghausen in September? His mother must have offered him some sort of explanation. And whatever it was, it had not turned him against Marianne. For that she was grateful. Benita had died in her sleep, according to the telegram. But Marianne had understood. It was her fault Benita was dead. Her meddling had killed her. She would never outlive this. What Martin understood of his mother's death remained unclear. He was an inscrutable boy. Not just now, in his grief, but always. Unlike Fritz, no matter where Martin went, he was well-liked. He was popular with his peers and with his teachers, the kind of boy parents were happy to invite to their homes. He was agreeable and excelled in school. But what he cared about, what he felt passion for, remained mysterious. He had inherited his father's likability without his streak of rebellion and strong-mindedness.
"Will you recognize your aunts?" she asked him.
"Lotte and Gertrude?" Martin looked worried. He had met them only a few times.
"Never mind," Marianne said. "We'll find them together."
Martin did recognize them, though, thank God, because Marianne never would have identified the two drab, middle-aged ladies waiting on the platform as Benita's sisters. One was tall and square-jawed and wore incongruously peaky cat-eye glasses. Her graying hair was tucked into several neat but unartful rolls. The other was medium height and softer in appearance, with a wide, doughy face and bright blue eyes. Neither looked anything like Benita. Where had she come from?
"Tante Lotte. Tante Gertrude,"
Martine asked, approaching the women with childish uncertainty. The taller of the two nodded, but she offered no smile, no warm greeting, no expression of condolence, only a grim nod and a handshake. One for Martine and one for Marianne. At least the dough-faced sister, who introduced herself as Gertrude, gave Martine an awkward pat on the shoulder. Marianne felt sorrow for her dead friend. How could a woman who had so loved beauty and fine things have lived here with these stark sisters in this ugly place? A memory rose to the surface. A day in the early summer, shortly before they had moved from Berglingenfels, she and Benita and Anya and all the children had taken a picnic out to the hillside. An old tablecloth from Weislau, embroidered by Albrecht's grandmother. A basket of cold meatballs and potato salad, pickles, fresh plums, a thermos of coffee, and Anya's butter cake with raisins. The hayfield buzzed with insects and meadow larks, and smelled of hot grass and flowering nettles. Below them a field of rapeseed bloomed a brilliant, otherworldly yellow. The air above shimmered with heat. Marianne had brought a camera, the first one she had ever owned, and she snapped pictures of the children running helter-skelter. "This is what we live for, isn't it?" Benita had said, her face flushed with happiness. On this cold December day, Frühlinghausen was the opposite of this. From the train station, Lotte and Gertrude took them directly to the cemetery. They wanted to show Martin his mother's plot before the service and the burial, scheduled for the following day. "Probably because he was expected to pay for it," was Marianne's uncharitable thought. "Should she be buried here in Frühlinghausen?" Lotte had asked Marianne during their one telephone conversation. "Where else?" Not beside Connie, whose remains had been disposed of as a traitor's, buried in some pit or burned in a Nazi crematory. No one had ever been told exactly where. Marianne felt revulsion toward the whole endeavor of burial. Bodies so precious in life, then suddenly in death so awkward and full of horror. She would be cremated and have her ashes scattered at the castle. None of this delicate balance between earthly preservation and rot. The sisters had hired a local farmer with a wagon to take them to the graveyard, and they rode in silence. Marianne squeezed Martin's hand as the horse jerked over the cobblestones. The cemetery was a humble place at the very edge of town, enclosed by an ugly new cement wall. At one end, it was bordered by fields, plowed and turned, nothing but dirt clods at this time of year, stretching toward the horizon. At the other sat the last of a row of grubby brick cottages. Two boys kicked a soccer ball in the backyard, bouncing it off the cemetery wall. Otherwise, there was only the sound of wind blowing across the fields, and the caw of a raven from above. The wagon driver grinned and nodded as they climbed down as if they were off to a party. The graves were elevated in the traditional way. Small, coffin-sized plots bordered by stone, planted with flowers, all scraggly and dead. Lotta led them to the spot already dug out for Benita. Beside her mother, Ilse Gruber, 1880-1940. Marianne blinked tears back fiercely. This was not the time and place to cry. She was aware of Martin, standing still as a statue beside her. "It's a nice place," Lotte asserted crisply. "People take care of the graves. Gertrude and I come once a week to visit mother and our brothers, so we will be here often. This is the yellow rose bush," she pointed at a trimmed stalk, tied up for winter. "And here we plant pansies and lavender. The ivy is good, too, because it covers so much." The subject of the flowers made her talkative, but Marianne only half listened. This was where Benita would lie, return to the roots she had tried so hard to leave behind, and a part of her life that Marianne had never known. But what had she known? Very little, maybe. Not of Benita and her love affair, or of Anya, who was not Anya, and with whom she had not spoken since that day in the castle. Standing at the grave, Marianne was suddenly aware of her own blindness. Her dearest friends were like dreams she had woken from. How had she missed so much?
What's that? Martine asked, bringing her back to the present moment. He pointed at a small cart beside a pile of dirt.
Turn over, Lotta said, following his hand. Every 30 years they dig up the graves to make room for new ones.
Oh, Martine nodded, but his eyes looked shocked.
If there is a marker, they will preserve it, of course,
Lotta continued in her matter-of-fact way.
But often with the old graves there is none.
She sniffed.
It keeps the cemetery,
she searched for the word.
Fresh? No grave is forgotten, because no one here has been dead for more than 30 years.
Marianne stared. She thought of her own family plot in Pomerania with its ancient graves. Her grandparents and great-grandparents and their parents before them, in the shade of a giant chestnut tree, and of the von Lingenfels Cemetery in Weislau, with its plots dating back to the 18th century. Certainly there was no one left to tend these. Did the Poles, who had taken their land, roll the graveyard right into the wheat field beside it? Apparently, this was the new way, a rapid turnover of bodies.
And after 30 years?
Marianne asked.
No one is remembered.
Lotta stared at her with a blank expression.
Remembered, maybe, but not tended. Not maintained.
Later, after the funeral, and after Marianne had brought Martine back to school, she returned to Tollingen. No one was there to greet her. She walked from the train station to the town square and stared up at her flat. Its windows looked dark and sad in the shadow of evening, and she could not bring herself to go inside. Behind her, in the square, the wild boar began setting its outdoor tables. Mothers pulled their children home to supper. Shop workers closed shutters. Lovers strolled hand in hand. And there were men on the streets again, smoking cigarettes and hurrying home to their families, happily returned to everyday life.
She felt a pang of sadness for Albrecht, for Connie, for all those who had not lived to see this new life.
She could not go upstairs to the kitchen she had once shared with Benita and make herself a lonely egg and toast. She could not sit in the twilit parlor and sort through Albrecht's papers. She could not pass by all those empty rooms. Benita's, Martin's, her own children's.
And she could not go visit Anya,
sit in her warm kitchen, remember Benita together and be comforted. Marianne left her bag behind the stairs in the foyer and walked toward the river at the edge of town. At least she could sit here and mourn, among the bones of all the poor souls who had died on its banks. She could lie on the grass and look at the stars and be lulled by the rush of the river's poisons. But as she neared the riverbank, she realized she was not alone. A figure, half obscured by shadow, stood with his back to the water, swaying a little on his toes. His lips moved slightly, and she could hear his low, murmuring voice, speaking a language she did not understand.
Eventually, his words came to an end.
"Excuse me," she said as he turned and took in her presence.
He was a young man, maybe 25, even if his face was much older. He wore a black hat and his hair in long curls. A Jewish DP from one of the few remaining camps.
"It's allowed," he said.
Marianne stared at him, confused.
"It's allowed to pray here," he clarified.
"Of course."
She stepped back, startled that he thought she would question this.
"Did you know someone? Among the dead?"
The man scowled and then squinted at her as if trying to read her intent.
"I knew them all," he said.
The words hung between them.
"I also came here to pray,"
Marianne said, realizing as she spoke that this was true. Above them, the first stars of evening were suddenly visible, like holes in a thin cloth, revealing a great light behind the darkness. The river shone a pale and otherworldly violet. The man regarded her intently, and Marianne found herself awaiting some sort of verdict. Finally, he ducked his head.
"Well, go on, then," he said.
You can be here forever with that task.
He turned to go.
And you?
Marianne said. He looked back at her.
I leave tomorrow for America.
And looking at him, this young stranger with an old face, Marianne felt the truth of his words and his weariness. But through this she heard the word America, as if for the first time. Not as the name of an enemy nation or as an ally, not as the originator of bombs and oranges and chocolate, or as the creator of all the paperwork she had so tirelessly filled out for so many refugees. She heard it as the name of a place where a person could begin again. Long after the man had departed, the word blew around in her mind, like a scrap of paper, alluring and brightly colored, hinting at another life. Part 4 Chapter 32 Deer Isle, Maine, July 1991 The road to Marianne's home on the coast of Maine was as winding and lovely as the name Von Lingenfels, which Martine had always thought beautiful, though it had lost some of its lightness on the American tongue. But Martine was not an American, even after so many years living in New England. He was a German, as this visit reminded him. A German who was more than an hour late, which was not a promising start. His tardiness was fitting, though. As a boy, he had always been late. He could feel the old pattern of behavior rising, his tendency to fulfill other people's narratives, usually at a cost to himself. So he was to be the hapless teenager, Marianne the overbearing parent, picking up his mother's slack. Never mind that he was now in his 50s and she was 83, and he had not seen her for God knows how long. She had written him to say she had a proposal, and while he wasn't generally up for proposals since his most recent divorce, he could not refuse Marianne. It had always been that way. The turn off Route 114 onto Marianne's little clamshell-strewn way was marked by a profusion of beech plum blossoms, which she had not mentioned in her directions. Possibly because at her age she did not venture far enough to have seen them, but more likely because a thicket of flowers and shiny purple berries was not the sort of thing Marianne made note of, while the sturdy aluminum mailbox, now all but obscured by the bushes, was. Her house was the last of the seven or eight that lined the road, and when Martine pulled around the corner, he was struck not only by its loveliness, a little gray-shingled cottage with a peaked roof and wraparound porch, but by its utter Americanness. It was rough-hewn and impermanent-looking. Its wide sliding glass doors lent it a quality of carefree openness, such a great contrast to Berg Lingenfels. "Americans can face the world with open arms," Marianne had once said, "because the world hasn't yet come to knock it down." Before he could climb out of the car, the front door opened, and there she was, Marianne von Lingenfels, at once totally recognizable and completely changed. She walked with a cane and wore a pair of thick, squarish glasses, but her gray hair was pulled back from her face in the same practical manner it had always been, with a clip on each side just above her ears, and her voice, barking his name, rang straight from his past.
"Marianne,"
Martine said, slamming the car door behind him. A broad, pure smile spread across her wrinkled face. Here she was, unmoored from the circumstances that for him had always defined her. In America, in Maine, for Christ's sake. Yet unlike Martine, who was a chameleon, an adapter to even the strangest situations, Marianne remained completely herself. From the shore came the sound of the surf, and overhead the seagulls screeched. The front door of the house swung open again, and a mournful-faced black woman with her hair braided close against her skull emerged.
"You all right, Marianne?" she asked softly.
"Oh, yes,"
Marianne said, keeping her eyes on Martin. Her smile remained fixed, an outpouring of happiness.
"Alice?"
"This is my dear friend, Martin."
Martin climbed the steps and extended his hand, which Alice accepted shyly. Then he turned to Marianne, grasped her gnarled fingers between his, and kissed her delicate, shriveled cheeks.
"Ach, Marty,"
she said, clinging to his hands.
"Du bist das Ebenbild deines Vaters."
"You are the picture of your father." Martin continued to smile, but the words resurrected the old familiar dismay. His father, the resister, the great man, the almost liberator of Germany and almost saver of so many millions of lives. Marianne had always shone a bright light on the chasm between Martin and this man.
"Come, have a cup of coffee. Or maybe you would like something stronger. A glass of schnapps after your journey?"
Marianne said, speaking in English now. "Coffee would be fine," Martin replied.
"Sit,"
Marianne commanded when they had reached the covered part of the porch, where a set of mildewy wicker furniture was grouped like so many pigeons, facing the sea.
"Alice will bring it,"
Martin complied. From here one could see down to a short T-shaped dock, sticking like a cross into the water. The sun on the rocks was strong and bright. Marianne lowered herself into the armchair opposite Martin, which looked as uncomfortable as his. Comfort, it seemed, was no more relevant to Marianne now than it had been when she was young.
"So how are you, Marianne?" Martin said, trying to strike a jovial tone.
"Oh, Martin," she said, sighing. "As well as possible for a person of my age. I am a lucky woman."
"Not old at all," Martin responded,
aware as soon as he said it that she would find the statement ridiculous.
"You look marvelous."
"Thank you."
Marianne bobbed her head patiently.
"And what of you, Martin Fledermann?"
She smiled.
"It was New York, I think,
where I saw you last."
"No?" "Yes, it was,"
Martin said, the day coming clear in his own head with her prompting. He had gone to see her in some big featureless building on the Upper East Side, where she had been living at the time. They drank tea and ate buttered Pfefferkuchen, and looked out over the city through a drafty picture window, surrounded by all the old things. Dark Biedermeier armoires and claw-footed tables, thick white-embroidered curtains, and the dusty needlepoint portrait of Großmutter von Lingenfels. Martin had just divorced his second wife, a subject he had been preoccupied with not discussing, and that now loomed over the memory as if in fact she had been there, a lovely, sorrowful presence full of reproach. The rest of the visit, what he and Marianne had discussed, how she had looked, was obliterated from his mind.
"You were working on something. A book. I can't remember the subject now."
"Ah, yes. Right," Martin nodded. "I'm still working on it."
"Still?" Marianne raised her eyebrows. "The same book."
"The same book," Martin tried to say with self-deprecating humor, but it came out sounding bitter.
The truth was that the book had become the bane of his existence. He had begun his career as a professor with a burst of glory, a lauded first book about post-war anti-fascist architecture, various academic prizes, and tenure at a well-regarded American university. But then he was gripped by a crippling stiflement. He was meant to write a book that came to terms with something larger than the architecture of renewal. He was meant to write a book that would, in some way, relate to his father, the hero and resister. But that book refused to come. He leaned back and was rewarded with a stab of broken wicker into his spine.
"That is a long time,"
Marianne frowned, studying him. A probing silence threatened.
"How did you come to this place?" Martin asked.
"It's home." He searched for the word. Primal presented itself. But Marianne was too German. He was too German to use the word without discomfort.
"Obscure,"
he filled in. Marianne laughed.
"It was difficult for you to find, I think."
"No, no." Martin tamped down his instinct to bristle. "I mean, just this corner of the country."
It's not anywhere Elizabeth and Katharina come, is it?
Elizabeth and Katharina, those dark-haired girls he had spent so much time with as a boy, now lived unfathomable lives in the brash, historyless American West. They, too, had been drawn here, to this continent of new beginnings, fellow children of Burg Lingenfels. Of the von Lingenfels family, only Fritz, a copyright lawyer at an international law firm, remained in Germany.
No, no, Katharina vacations in Mexico. As the Caribbean?
Marianne waved his question away.
And Elizabeth doesn't vacation.
Well, it's a long way from Burg Lingenfels.
Ha! I should say so.
Marianne laughed.
And you are in New Hampshire still? I understand from Irina. She is in better touch with me than you are. She sends a Christmas card, at least.
Does she?
Irina?
Martin was startled. He tried to imagine his daughter, the inscrutable suburban schoolteacher she had become, writing to Marianne.
Every year? Last year with a picture of her babies. So sweet little things. To think you are a grandfather, Martin.
Martin shook his head. It was incredible, actually. He was only 52. Irina was a child of his youth. He had been too young, only 24 when he had her. And now she was a mother herself,
also too young in his estimation.
Fatherhood had slipped between his fingers and time hiccuped forward.
Now here he was, a grandparent.
Too late. Too late. Grandparenthood taunted him.
You can't go back and be a father now.
I'm not a very good one, I'm afraid, Martin said.
Ah.
Marianne waved this away, too.
I'm sure you are.
Martin said nothing. Sitting here on this weather-beaten porch, with its brittle railings and the dull pounding of the sea below, he felt a gray bloom of failure. This was why it had been so long since he had last seen Marianne. She was the gardener of this ugly flower. She knew just how to turn its face to the sun. He was relieved to hear Alice opening the screen door, bearing a tray with Marianne's good coffee pot, pale blue with tiny white flowers. How familiar it still was. A carton of half and half, and two practical white mugs that had replaced the Meissen china of the old days.
Have we no pitcher for the cream? Marianne frowned. This looks not fine.
No, ma'am, Alice murmured.
No pitcher.
Ach,
well, so it is.
Marianne sighed.
But surely there is a sugar bowl.
Alice nodded and returned to search for one. She is Rwandan, Marianne asserted when she had left. Her husband was killed in the genocide. And her son.
My God, how terrible.
She is very good. Very honest. Martin nodded. Marianne had always been comfortable with such sweeping moral pronouncements.
You see, Marianne said, smiling, I like always to surround myself with widows.
I suppose so. Martin tried to smile back.
I miss your mother, you know, Marianne said. She was not one for a house full of widows.
The comment jarred him. He was so rarely around anyone who spoke of his mother.
But she lived in one, Martin said.
I think of that man she saw,
Marianne continued, fixing her gaze on the dock.
After the war, the ex-Nazi.
Herr Müller,
Martin offered, though his own memory of the man was hazy at best. He had been astonished when Marianne told him of his mother's affair, so many years ago. But he had not been alarmed. His own memories of the man were positive. He had shared his Christmas chocolate with him on that long-ago day.
I was very hard on her about him,
Marianne continued.
I think if she loved him and he loved her...
She shook her head.
This is the main thing, isn't it?
At that moment, Alice reappeared, carrying a cereal bowl half filled with sugar.
Aha! Uh-huh. Well,
Marianne said, breaking the somber mood.
We live in elegance here, don't we, Alice?
Maybe so.
Alice smiled shyly. She had a scar on her neck, Martin noticed, a thin white line that snaked down from her ear.
Love is the thing we agree, is it not?
Marianne asked. Alice looked from Marianne to Martin. Yes, ma'am, she said when it became clear that Marianne was addressing her. Love is great.
You see, Marianne said to Martin, this is what I mean to say. Love is great.
Martin felt suddenly consumingly tired. The heaviness of the exchange, the awkwardness of the moment. What had he expected?
Would you like anything else?
Alice asked in her soft, pleasantly accented voice.
No, no. Except a schnapps for Martin. He needs one, I think.
It was maybe an hour or two later, with the sun softening to forgiving afternoon ripeness, that Marianne posed the question. It wasn't a question, actually. She placed a card in front of him. Thick white stationery like a wedding invitation. The return address caught his eye. Berglingenfels. Inside was a postcard with a black and white photograph of a woman squinting at the camera, shielding her eyes against the sun, one rubber-booted foot propped on a low wall. Marianne at the cistern. Marianne von Lingenfels, moral compass of the resistance, was printed underneath. Martin looked up at her, surprised.
Yes, it's me. A biography?
Marianne made a gesture of dismissal.
That's wonderful, Martin said, turning the card over.
A remarkable story of a woman at the heart of one of the most courageous stands against evil in our time, he began to read.
Oh, it's a little much, Marianne said,
though she could not fully conceal her pride.
But that's not the point. There is a party, this fall, at Berglingenfels.
Martin sat back.
A weekend of talks, discussions, and meditations on the subject of resistance.
He read aloud.
Martin, Marianne said, leaning forward, I want you to take me there, and I want to find Anya and bring her too. I want to invite you both as my guests.
Martin sighed.
I would love to, Marianne, but I don't know.
Stop. She lifted a hand. Don't say no. I won't let you say no. Think about it first.
It is the wish of an old woman.
Think of it, if you want,
as my last wish.
Martin looked at her, the thin gray hair, the fragile, papery skin of her face.
Why do you want me to come with you?
Marianne cocked her head to the side.
Why do you think, Martin Fledermann?
Because I am my father's son, he sighed.
No.
Marianne said, knitting her brows,
because you are your mother's son.
It was not decided in that moment. The sun sank lower in the sky, and at Marianne's formidable insistence, Martin took her for a swim.
Swim where? He asked when she proposed the idea. Where?
Marianne laughed.
Look around you, Martin Fledermann. The sea.
The swim trunks she provided were folded dustily on the top shelf of the towel closet. A voluminous pair of brightly flowered shorts. A style Martin dimly recalled from his early days in America as jams. Her son-in-law's, apparently. Martin was a good swimmer, albeit out of practice. As a boy, he had been the star of the Zellum swim team. But it was years since he had swum in the ocean, and never with an 83-year-old. Marianne wore a blue-skirted suit with violent splotches of purple. Against this, her skin was a pale greenish-gray, finely webbed with wrinkles. Her arm was looped through a bright pink inner tube.
Ah, she said, beaming. My swim escort.
You really want to do this? He asked, as lightly as possible, though in fact he felt vaguely panicked.
He might be responsible for Marianne von Lingenfels's drowning. People would shake their heads and wonder what sort of idiot had allowed an old woman to climb into the cold northern Atlantic Ocean.
Come, Marianne said. We will have an adventure.
She wrapped his hand under her arm and clutched it against her bony ribcage. From the porch, there was a dusty path and a set of wooden steps over the rocks, which led to the dock. His bare feet